Okay, thank you. Thank you, Debbie. I thought that was incredibly valuable as setting the context for the 12 points of Berlin within the broader framework of the ICCJ's various projects, as you call them, their broader activities. I want to start off in a rather different tact by briefly reflecting on the significance of interreligious understanding and relations in our contemporary world. At the opening of the EU Parliament in Brussels this year, two issues were identified as overwhelming concerns facing the community. The first was the Eurozone responses to the ongoing impact of the 2008 global financial crisis, generated, as we know, by highly irresponsible and immoral banks. This is going to worsen before improving. The second issue, and not unrelated in my mind, is the relationships between the different ethnic and religious groups within the EU countries. And so the issue we're dealing with is an issue, I suspect they've got the order wrong, but an order of absolute priority. And so we're not talking about something that is a small number of us who may be involved with the CCJ or involved with our religious communities. This is an issue of magnitude, of significance, that faces us all. Now, this is the first thing I want to establish, but the relationship between different religio-moral communities is also a determinative factor in the US presidential elections later this year. With each passing, I'm addicted to the American elections. I'm not quite sure why, but they always seem much more interesting than ours in New Zealand. As each month passes, the moral fractures and divisions become more and more significant and more evident. The fault lines in the recent and current condemnations of multiculturalism in Europe and the US, and they had their echoes in Australia and New Zealand, are religious divisions. The failure of multiculturalism, as David Cameron expressed openly, is not a failure of multiculture, but it's been a failure of interreligious relations. And so I was very interested in Debbie's comments about biculturalism. And, of course, here we have an ongoing debate between biculturalism and multiculturalism. And many of those who support multiculturalism are those who are least hospitable. One MP, who is not very far from here, is not very hospitable to biculturalism. And the inverse is also true, that many of those who are committed to biculturalism are less open and less warm to multiculturalism. And actually, your analysis, from the Psalms of the 2000s, is a very interesting way to look at this issue in New Zealand, because there's a lot of unfinished business between Māori and Pākehā that won't be solved by Peter Dunn's Multiculturalism Act, to mandate that. They're different issues, and I thought that was a very healthy and helpful way to think about these. Put starkly, one of our global priorities is simply to learn to live peacefully together, not without our profound differences, but in spite of them. This will require unprecedented levels of commitment and understanding. The alternative is just so dire as for me to be unthinkable, so I never think about it. You can if you want, but it's just awful and awesome. We've no choice but to actually improve, the way in which we live together. And my hope and what we're all doing here, is facing up to that. But the question the second big question I want to look at is, what's Christian-Jewish relations? What have they got to do with this? In an era when Jewish-Christian and Christian-Jewish relations are not only not central to global tensions and conflicts, but perhaps not even a significant priority. What importance do these have in Europe today, or in South Asia, or in the Caucasus? My considered view is that organizations like ICCJ, CCJ, are the pioneers of modern dialogical movements. The history began during the Second World War in Britain in 1942 When the Council on Christians and Jews was founded by Chief Rabbi Hertz and Archbishop William Temple, and it's their 70th anniversary this year. At a time when invasion loomed, rationing was the order of the days, and austerities that went way beyond those that Chancellor Merkel seeks to impose on Greece, it's hard for us to recover just how radical the formation of the CCJ was. And I looked at the Times report, and the very interesting thing is it didn't make the front page of the Times on the 1st of October 1942, but it addressed the German government. It was a very interesting thing. So the context, it was very historically specific. And it called on all Christians to condemn anti-Semitism. And so it made a very, very strange disjuncture that in a letter the following day in the Times complained. The suggestion was that somehow the anti-Semitism of the National Socialist Party in Germany impacted or stained other Christian anti-Semitism. But the Temple and Hertz knew exactly what they were doing. The appeal was for Christians to oppose anti-Semitism. Christians in Britain, but also Christians in Germany. And that's still an issue, and I'm going to come back to that a bit later. But this project continued by the ICCJ at Sigismund, as we heard, after the Shoah, to the current 38 countries with CCJs, or their equivalents. In 60 years, a tremendous amount has been achieved by the CCJs, by the ICCJ, but also by many other religious communities, organizations, and individuals. In the last 60 years, the centuries of mistrust haven't been overcome, but they've been systematically and in a sustained way challenged. The persecutions of the past have been acknowledged by some, and that's a huge achievement. Cooperative programs of education and social action have been started and continue. The most dramatic changes have taken place, those which I refer to as unthinkable in 1947 or 1942, are those that Debbie mentioned. The Vatican II, Nostra Aetate. I was recently, with one of my classes, looking at the 1988 Lambeth Conference, which its openness, not only, the Anglican Church to Jews, but other faiths, is enormously risk-taking and brave and courageous of them. And from the Jewish side, Deborah mentioned Deborah Emet, which was 2000. And I went to the launch of it. It was an amazing thing, and it's still well worth reading and engaging with. And there's a very fine commentary by one of the four authors, Peter Oakes, which looks at its ongoing implications. it's important and not. And it's important because it was signed by a couple of hundred people, but mostly conservatives and liberals of various sorts, progressive Jews of various sorts. Not one Orthodox rabbi signed it. One did?
David Rosen signed it.
Okay, but he's not on the original document. He was an addition to the thing, yeah. And we should expect him to sign it. He's your predecessor, yeah. But it wasn't signed by the original signatures. It wasn't signed by one Orthodox rabbi. And that wasn't, according to Peter Oakes, when I spoke to him about it, not for want of trying. And it hasn't been a document, in spite of a very fine book that accompanies it, that has had reach into the communities. And that's the second thing I'm going to come back to, which is reach into the communities. The world we live in has changed dramatically since the 1940s, and I wasn't born to the 1950s, the world that I've grown up in has changed. Secularism is a very significant issue today. Christian anti-Semitism is still widely present, but certainly less evident and less overt. Mutual ignorance has been markedly reduced in some areas, and while supersessionism, as Debbie said, has been tackled in a number of places, the issue by Christians of Jewish concerns about Israel and security have largely remained untouched. The movement over the last 70 years, if we can call it a single movement, has had the most amazing successes. It's bitten deeply into education, theological and academic. Public sensibilities, have changed. And it's played a part in the construction of the very post-Shoah world that we all live in. The issues of today are by no means less significant or less, the number of hurdles less than in 42 or 47. And they will require the same degree of moral courage, bravery, insight and commitment in tackling them as they did then. Before coming directly to the concerns of the 12 points of Berlin, we need to consider another reason why Jewish and Christian relations are central to inter-religious relations. Now, I want to say something more than Debbie was saying. They're vital because of unfinished business and the unique and discrete nature of the relationship. But the success of the pioneering Christian-Jewish relations, I want to contend, is a barometer for all inter-religious relationships. If Jews and Christians can't make it, and what I mean by that is sustain and develop relationships that prove robust enough to withstand the inevitable strains that characterize genuine religious differences. My view is there's not a hope in hell for Muslim-Christian relations, Buddhist-Hindu relations, Jewish-Hindu relations, etc., etc. We, the CCJ, the ICCJ, are the canary in the fragile set of relationships in the mine of the interreligious human family. We have to be careful. It would be much too easy to just move on and say, we tried Jewish-Christian relations, they're just too hard. It's probably easier to talk to the Muslims or the Sikhs, or I went to a dialogue a couple of years ago which was Jews and Tibetan Buddhists. It was very, not a lot of baggage or dirty laundry needs to come with you. I suspect that Jewish-Christian relationships will be proven to be central in the development of wider multilateral and new bilateral interreligious relations. And I can't overemphasize this. I was deeply shocked 4 years ago in Canada where the Toronto Interreligious Council, the Jewish members withdrew over Israel. The head of the minutes of the meeting, the head of the minister said, well, that's fine, we'll just carry on without them. We've got very good relationships with the Muslims and the Hindus. And so the idea that you can cut out of the partnership, that those relationships are integral. The very motivations for Christian dialogue with other faiths has been shaped and formed by Jewish-Christian dialogue. So I think that we need to not forget that and to realize how central that is as a concern. Now, in spite of the successes of 60 years or 70 years, depending on which one we're measuring, there have been serious limitations. They've been not everything has been achieved in ways that we might have thought. The agenda has had limited impact on the Jewish world, and this is we find again. I've travelled extensively in the Jewish world. I know the Jewish world, and these issues, don't fall into the high on the agenda. Interfaith dialogue isn't a Jewish priority, and Jewish-Christian relations are not priorities, or Muslim-Jewish priorities. And you might have thought that in the post-Shoah Jewish world, mutual understanding with Christians would have been an absolute priority. And I've written about this. I think the relationship, the historic relationship, that just as Jews and or Christians have inevitably to engage with Jews as part of their history, my contention is that after the Holocaust, Jews have to engage with Christianity. But they haven't done so in quite the way, or it's been rare. Jewish understanding of Christianity, whenever this is tested, is frighteningly poor, as is our knowledge of Islam or other religions for that matter. As Steve Protheroe shows, who's a friend of mine at Boston University, we are not only notoriously ignorant of other religious traditions, we're notoriously ignorant of our own. And Jews score very badly on this. We don't know a great deal about Judaism, but this is considerably more than we know about other faiths. But it's lamentable. If you think Prothero is having a go at Jews, he did these wonderful questionnaires and tested Christians on knowledge of Christianity, and it was truly abysmal. He also tested American Muslims, and they're abysmal too. So we shouldn't, none of us stand freed in that particular way. We like the Christian world, consider that in a world of secular assimilationism, our first responses are defensive. We want to protect and conserve our traditions. We want to protect ourselves and our communities as our first priority. And indeed, there's much merit in this position. It's important that Jews preserve their own tradition before running after reading the New Testament, I mean, as the Berlin point says. It's vital that we all have understanding. It's important that Muslim children learn the Quran before they start worrying about other things. And so that seems significant. And there is merit in that. But everything has changed. The churches have changed. The mosques have changed. But there are a new set of issues, and the issues are between, if we look at the churches, between their conservative and liberal wings, where the divisions are evident over gender and sex and other so-called button issues. And this raises a new set of issues for this dialogue and all dialogues. The literality of many evangelicals and Pentecostals has impacted in a major way on Jewish-Christian relations, undoing much of the effort to read the New Testament in a more nuanced and historically contextualized fashion, returning to older, more prejudicial patterns. There's growing evidence that those who have an unsophisticated and literal reading of their scriptures, whatever faith they're in, they don't understand their own interpretive traditions, they don't understand their own histories, I mean, are increasingly prejudicial about others. We need to understand the historicity and the context of our own texts. My own reading of evangelical literature for part of the course that I teach evidences the revival of demonic and other negativities about Jews and Judaism. And so one of the things that's taking place is, as people become more committed, and they're often smaller numbers but very vocal in the growing sectors of the Christian churches, some of the material that is widely disseminated, I mean, is deep and shocking. I've just read a very recent study, which is about curses, which is by a leading evangelical author. It's a book that has now gone into 7 printings and is widely read by American evangelicals, which says that if you are Christian and you go into synagogues, you won't notice immediately, but you'll probably break your leg on the way home, develop cancer, some terrible thing will happen because of the demons that inhabit these places. I'm not making this up, but these people sell much more than I ever do, writing books and articles. So, and they have hugely more impact. So these are real issues for our time, that on the one hand, we have a kind of undoing of everything we are doing. And it's often done, I mean, in the best of faith. I mean, and that sounds, I mean that to sound slightly ironic, but true. Alongside this is the evangelical, I call them technologies of the last days, that lead to widespread support for Medina Israel, even if this ties into an imminent second coming where all the Jews are going to convert to Christianity. One of my research students, Sean Dibben, is... some of you may know Sean, actually. Do you know Sean? No? Who did a wonderful MA on Christian Zionism, is now doing his PhD. He's just come back from 3 weeks in Israel, where he accompanied a group from Texas on their Holy Land tour. And these are Christian Zionists. And he recently sent me, he's in Israel at the moment, but he sent me a lovely photograph of himself with John Hagee. These are quite amazing theologies but theologies which are, have a wide and deep reach in American evangelical Christianity, but are dialogues and positive relationships with Jews in Israel, which are based on, I mean, not on honest theologies, and they're very, very problematic. So you have two things happening that we need to be alert to and we need to understand. Here, the honey and the sting accompany each other, as they so often do with, I mean, relationships and dialogue. Christian-Jewish relationships have never been a priority among the mainstream denominational churches, and that doesn't mean that individuals haven't responded to them. But there have always been other things that are more significant. They're beset with other concerns, empty pews, diminishing congregations, and the churches that are growing have little interest in more subtle and nuanced readings of Scripture. And you have to be very, very careful. I published something, a little comment about a American parachurch group focused on the family who are not very positive about Jews and Judaism, in spite of them sharing some pragmatic interest with some Jews, which resulted in a request from their lawyers to retract and very serious threats. So these aren't all nice people, and we need to be aware of that too. We're at a critical juncture. The generations are passing, as they inevitably must. Many Christian scholars, such as the influential Isabel Wollaston, a pioneer in English Christian theological studies of the Holocaust, have insisted on making a division between the Shoah and the State of Israel. She says, "I acknowledge the Christian responsibility for the Shoah, theological, physical, individual, and collective, but this cannot mute my open hostility to the State of Israel." Now, there is exactly, you alluded to this, but there is a growing division where making, it's said in the 12 points of Berlin, it's hard sometimes where these things aren't nuanced and the language, as you say, is much too subtle there in some cases, that we're to make, as if it was easy to make a distinction between criticism of one thing and criticism of another. And it's often much more problematic and harder to do, and people aren't as careful with their language as Debbie and her colleagues. And sometimes the subtlety of that response is too sophisticated for some of the distinctions and some of the criticisms that are being made. The theological terrain is changing and new assumptions coming to the fore, and increasing levels of Christian Muslim dialogue are increasing, not in tandem with Jewish Christian dialogue and even of Muslim Jewish dialogue, but sometimes at odds with them. And so there's a real need for these things can work against each other. And so not, I take Debbie's point about them keeping them separate, but they need to work in tandem, and there needs to be a great deal of contact between these different developments. It's vital that dialogue across dialogical relations maintain, but there are unique histories within unique contexts like the CCJ. The 12 points of Berlin seem to me to be just as radical as Seelisburg in a new 21st century context. They're a deliberate attempt, they say so, to revive the enthusiasm and commitment, but in the second decade of the 21st century. They seem to me to display enormous wisdom by addressing Jewish and Christian communities distinctly and separately and together. This might put an end to Jews always being in a much more passive role of educating Christians about Judaism, but rarely vice versa. And I've been to too many meetings over 30 years where very well-meaning Jews are just going to tell you Christians, you know, how it is, and then we've got to go home. Because we're not really that interested in how it is for you. And this made sense in 1947, but it hasn't made sense for the last 20 years, and it certainly doesn't make sense for the future. The differences between Judaism and Christianity are real, and they necessitate real and different responses. And I think that's an amazing breakthrough and importance. The call to Christians recognizes the real challenge And the real challenge is set up right in the beginning of the document, to get Christian communities to join us to continue to remove the vestiges of contempt of Jews and to make connections with real Jews, not mythological ones. And that sums up the whole thrust of the document. The take-up of this agenda in the Christian churches globally is absolutely minimal. It's frighteningly, minor. And the job for all of us, Jews and Christians, is the awareness campaign that you mentioned. These issues are part of this broader agenda I started with, but they need to be sung from the turrets. We need to make people aware. And it's particularly significant that Christian churches are aware and take upon the agenda, and they have some take up at the grassroots level. And this is an enormous challenge. It's an enormous challenge, too, to get to know real Jews and real Jewish communities. Sometimes, as you say, there aren't a lot about. Others, there are, the members of the community are self-selecting who engage. And so these make these challenges much more difficult. What's very, very strange is when, like, Sean's PhD work is just talking. I've got some of the tapes of his interviews with Texans with this particular group that he's doing his work on, and they have almost no contact with Jews except for their visits to Israel, which are highly orchestrated and have particular purposes. And they have mythological accounts of Jews, as opposed to real ones. And the history of 2,000 years is a history of, the need to overcome these mythologies, these demonic associations, these even when they turn out to be highly positive ones, which endlessly praise Jewish innovations. Texans, Christian Zionists, know how many Jews have got Nobel Prizes in a way that's probably more fulsome than Jews do, but for completely the wrong reasons. They support a mythology rather than any relationships. The call to Christians, as I said, is enormous, and the size of the task to remove all vestiges of contempt of Jews is huge. It's powerful that it's articulated, but it runs amazingly deep. It runs deep through potential misunderstanding. Cardinal Pell recently has not made himself comfortable with Jews. I haven't even I've read the response. I watched the Q&A program, and the responses have been amazingly interesting. If you teach Judaism as I do, we have our first class asking people to write down what they know about Jews. And even in a secular place like New Zealand, the myths are deeply embedded in the Anglo-Christian culture. And so they're very, very evident. And removing those vestiges, this is an enormous task. You first have to know what's there before you can begin to tackle them. And my point is, they don't just need tackling in the churches, but in our culture. They run deeply in our culture. So much so that when you do have prejudice, it's often uttered because it's felt to be acceptable. And as long as it's not challenged, it is acceptable. And you only have to look at one of the books I read recently was Julius's Trials of the Diaspora, History of Antisemitism in England, which is a shocking read. But what's mostly shocking is the last part of it, which is about contemporary antisemitism. And it gave me a strange thought that many of the resonances of Anglo culture, Anglo legal culture, are resonances which are picked up in Australia and New Zealand. There's other one strange thing where we talk about biculturalism. I recently had a look at a set of materials that were sent to me. People, for reasons that are never quite clear, send me lots of sensible things and lots of not sensible things. But I was recently sent a management package, which is for a Māori management program, which is run by a particular church, which entertains and reanimates, revivifies tales of Wall Street bankers, of a Jewish financial conspiracy, which impacts on Māori in New Zealand. I've written to them and explained how silly this is. And given them references, which I'm sure they won't ever read. But it's very strange how these things find purchase again and again. That's because they're such absolutely wonderful tales and explain so much. And if you wondered about the Maori economic situation, a few mysterious mythological Jewish bankers explain absolutely everything. Now, these agendas are significant, and I think we're at this critical juncture, as I said. Under the section biblically, Jesus' Jewish identity is still a secret in many Christian communities. It sounds unbelievable. It seems that we've been talking about anniversaries. George Foot Moore's article is 86 years ago it was published, on the Pharisees, which began this process in critical scholarship. But across New Zealand and the Pacific too, Paul's Jewish identity is also a secret, in terms of its Judaic elements. It's a secret for many more Jews, but for lots of Christians too. The parting of the ways, as people used to talk about, is infinitely more complicated than even the latest studies portray. And it's a very, very significant issue. This very, very last week was a reader for a thesis which is going to be published by an academic publisher. And it's a very fine piece of scholarship which is about the way in which temple ritual affected the early churches. And it's a continuation. But even the scholar who's written an excellent thesis, which I've recommended for publication, talks in the final chapter about the final parting of the ways, as if this took place in the middle of the second century. And it took place in a much more variegated and problematic way and to the middle of the fourth century. But Shlomo Pinez at the University, found Christian Jewish groups, operate and continue to operate as late as the ninth century. Yeah. There's only one group in the ninth century, and they seem to be quite confused. But he did publish a very learned article on the texts that were found. They were found in the Cairo Geniza. And they're very, very interesting. There's one group just south of Alexandria who hadn't got the good news or only got half the good news or from both sides. What I'm trying to say is that the idea of overcoming the misreading of the Christian tradition and the separation is much harder than you think and much more complicated. And it's not that it's said blithely in the Points of Berlin, but the enormity of that task is needs to be appreciated. And we're talking about scholarly consensus, if only. Not all of the agreed facts are agreed to make that happen. Liturgically, Christians are often surprised not only by the affinities of Jewish to Christian prayers, but also the formats and services and parallels such as the Kiddush. Drawing on Jewish interpretations, again, is very much more problematic than you might think. A few years ago at Purim, I happened to be in London, an old friend of mine invited me to the first Leo Beck College. They invited a whole lot of Christians, mainly from the London colleges, from King's College, some Anglicans, from Heathrop, some Catholics, to share in their reading of the Megillat Esther. But they didn't warn them that they were going to be rude, make noises. And one of the Catholics I spoke to later said that he thought this attitude towards scripture was disgusting, disgraceful. And they try and blot out Haman's name, and there was a lot of shouting. And they also, one of the traditions is to develop commentaries which are humorous, innovative, full of kiddushin, full of rabbinic novelties, but to do so in a playful way. And I was talking to this very, very nice Catholic later, he said, but that was just so offensive. it's harder than you think to engage. The Midrashim were not written for every Jew. They were written for learned Jews, and they certainly weren't written for most Christians. And so to think you can do this in a very simple way or an easy way, I think is optimistic, very, very optimistic. The second issue there is to promote inter-religious dialogue with no proselytizing, the need, the recognition for new theologies. Supersessionism is having all sorts of revivals, even as we contest it. The developments globally are towards greater conservatism and more supersessionism, not the reverse. The ending of the mission to the Jews raises very, very interesting questions. And just a kind of 30-second aside, I had a commission which was for a joint report to the Jewish Board of Deputies in London and to the then the Archbishop of Canterbury, and myself and an Anglican clergyman, Bill Clave, were asked to do a report on the church's, it changed its name from Mission to the Jews to Ministry for the Jews. And I spent a very, very engaging week of my life interviewing people whose job it was to convert Jews and to write a report. And it was a very, very strange experience at all. First, we looked at their accounts. That's where you should always start with religious organizations, to learn that they received more than £586,000, and this was in 1991, I wrote this, from each year from the Anglican Church. So they're quite well endowed. They had two nice properties. They had an agenda. They had two quite new Volvo motor cars, and they employed many, many too many people. So that was my first deep suspicion. In the year before, the final year we had their annual report, they had converted five Jews in the year of activity. And you don't have to do much very, very crude mathematics to divide five into 500,000. They're very, very expensive converts to Judaism. Three of the five had histories of serious mental illness. And so it's not that they weren't effective. I mean, they had no idea what they were doing. Their traveling exhibition was a joke. The leader of the group was introduced to me as a Holocaust survivor, but he was born in Lewisham. And he said he was a Holocaust survivor because his grandparents came from, he's a Jewish convert to Anglicanism, but I mean, his self-presentation was deeply suspect, I wrote in the report. And they were a shoddy group who basically spent a lot of time seeing if there were Jewish people in hospitals, which seemed to be their major activity, and doing a road show for young Christian Anglican groups that was, very, very silly, and it was called Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus, but largely it contained items that you can buy readily now in the Shuk in Jerusalem. And I mean, it was historically nonsense and probably theologically nonsense too. But they did have an agenda, and their agenda was to convert all the Jews in England, etc. We wrote the report. The result of the report was the Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Runcie, withdrew his patronage. And so I thought that was a huge achievement. But they didn't close it down, and it still exists. And the rather deep, shocking thing to me was the report from an Anglican clergyman and me was ever so clear. You know, this is nonsense, close it down. But it still exists. And it's still being funded, albeit at a slightly reduced rate. And I suspect, although I haven't looked closely, it's doing the same sort of damaging work and working against the things like the Lambeth Aims, etc. So there's a lot of kind of double think or not systematic thinking that goes on, and the issue of supersessionism, again, is harder to negotiate and manage, as the Presbyterian Church of Canada has discovered, theologically than it is as a kind of formal exercise. The section on... I suppose the point I'm trying to make about the Christian mission to the Jews and the Anglican mission is simply step by step. I mean, there's progress, but it's not going to happen in quite the way that you might think. The section on Jerusalem is radical, needed, problematic, and I found myself, when I first read it, very moved by it, and I think it's very powerful. I want to say two more quick things and then I'll finish. But the call for Jews to understand something about Christianity is immensely significant. And after the Holocaust, I think that it's a duty for Jews. It's not a religious duty, but it's a duty to understand the world we live in and to make sense of it. And the truly shocking thing is that Christians have wrestled with this, particularly German Christians, as you say, in the time I've been in Germany, and tried to understand how the unthinkable happened. The Jewish responses have been much less evidently so. Now, that sounds strange because there's a whole body of literature about the Holocaust and a whole body of sub-literature there about Holocaust theology. But its concerns have been about Judaism for very obvious reasons and not about Christianity. And not all those who've written have written knowingly and wisely, about it. There are also people like Ulrich Simon, there are also lots of Christian theologians who've done Holocaust theologies who haven't written wisely about, I suspect, Christianity too, but certainly not about Judaism. I'm just going to mention two authors that you ought to look at, and this is directed to the Jews in the room, but the Christians should read them too. I read, earlier this year, I read Daniel Boyarin's new book, The Jewish Gospels. And it's a wonderful, he's a friend and a great scholar, but it's a heartfelt Jewish attempt to understand the Gospels. And it's very powerful and very an important book. But it's written by by an Orthodox Jew. It's not written for any other agenda. And the impact on him is to think about something that's important from a Jewish perspective, but do it. It's probably better advice than reading the New Testament, curiously. You should read Boyarin first, my advice is, and then if you want to look at it, do. The second person who, died last year and was a scholar I knew, a great scholar, was Alan Siegel, who taught at Columbia and Barnard College at the and at Columbia University. And Siegel was a conservative Jewish scholar who dedicated his life to, it sounds rather strange, but historically trying to understand Christianity. But his view was that the Gospels and the Epistles are some of the most important and significant records, historical records, for understanding early Judaism. And so when he said that, this was in the late 70s, this was contested very seriously in the Jewish world. And he said, look, they're documents I need to read as a historian, of my own tradition. He wrote two books that are worth reading. Paul the Convert is the best of the Jewish studies in a kind of historical sense of Paul. There are better Jewish theological studies. Jacob Taube's study of Paul is quite brilliant, and actually having a huge impact in the Christian world, but almost no impact in the Jewish world. But Siegel's book is worth reading. In 1986, he also published Rebecca's Children, which is the kind of mature fruits of his study of Judaism and Christianity in the Roman world. And there's a kind of parallel history that we would do well to recover. But learning about the changes in the churches is also very significant, something that isn't always evident in our Holocaust theologies. And then finally, when you've read Siegel and Boyarin, you might read the New Testament, and you'd be surprised how familiar it is, and yet how different it is too. Now, my report, the joint calls to both communities. The issue here is a very, very significant one. I think that the issue to Australia and New Zealand, as in terms of grassroots responses, needs to be a bit like the trialogue you were talking about, the dialogue. The situation is very, very similar and very different religiously in Australia and New Zealand. And so we need a call to New Zealanders, a call to Australians, and a call to both of us. The local appropriations, we've just been evaluating at the university, I'm on our council, the new strategic plan, and we were given advice in the seminar, a strategic plan must have stretch. Stretch means you can't, if it's a five-year plan, it should take 5 years, and it should be hard to achieve. Hasn't got enough stretch, it's not a good strategic plan. So having recently been at these meetings, I wanted to think of the 12 points of Berlin in terms of stretch, I think they've got bags of stretch. there's plenty to do, and in that sense, I think they're very, very significant. The religious demographies in Australia and New Zealand are radically different. We share such a lot with Australia. We have approximately twice the number of people who have no religion. We have about half the number of Catholics. Those two things may not be unrelated. We have a church attendance rate which is about half that of Australia. That may also be related to the number of Catholics. We have a very, very similar diversity, but the proportions are radically different. So the so-called the category that statistics use and use are migrant faiths, such as faiths which are majority migrants, have a much lesser statistical role in New Zealand than in Australia. So they add up as a total to about 6.5%, whereas in Australia they're about 17-18%. So the demographies are different, which means the dialogues are different, the issues are different, and that seems very significant. We have another factor which is different too, which is where this cuts into the multiculturalism issue, which is that the migrant faiths don't include, for the Department of Statistics, Christianity. And yet one of the most significant factors in recent years that's transformed Christianity in New Zealand has been migrant Christians, who've brought migrant Christianity to New Zealand. And the impact of that has huge impacts that we're just beginning. I've got a student working on this, looking at in New Zealand. So we have Presbyterians and Methodists from Korea, Taiwanese Methodists. We've got Filipino Catholics. We've got Pacific Christians. We've got Samoan Methodists and congregations, Tongan Methodists, etc., etc., etc. We've got a Syrian Christian community now. All of these are impacting on community, and they impact disproportionately in terms of their numbers, because while they represent something like 4% of all Christians in the country, they represent something like 15% of those who go to church more than twice a month. And so migrant Christians have a much greater impact than their numbers, because they haven't been secularized by New Zealand culture yet, or however we want to see that. The issue here that's significant is that the document we're talking, documents like the 12 points of Berlin, are written in a highly articulate, theologically ramified, sophisticated European Anglo-American European context. And it bears very little relationship to the world of Filipino Christianity when I was in the Philippines. Almost no relationship to Korean Presbyterianism, and no relationship to the broad spectrum of Pacific Christianities. And the significance of that is that all of us in our work engage with this wider world, where the resonances are different, the European history that still undergirds, it's not an accident, it's got Berlin in it, are alien and mean different. Supersessionism in the Pacific and supersessionism in most East Asian Christianity is about, when I was in Korea, is about not being a Buddhist. It's not about Christianity and Judaism. And so it's much more like the opening to the book of Hebrews, which is a favored text, than the normal ways, than Romans 9 to 11, for argument's sake. And we need to know this, because this isn't a message that can get through, using the same language and the same theological frameworks as the 12 points of Berlin. I just give you an example, and then my very, very last point, I promise. But last year I went to the Apia Pentecostal Preachers Association for part of my research in a Chinese restaurant upstairs in Apia in Samoa. And it was a very, very sparkling thing. If anyone's ever been to a Pentecostal Preachers Minister Association, they all prayed together, some of them in tongues, but a terrible cacophony of voices. It wasn't very harmonious or attractive, but one of the preachers who had invited me there was preaching in English and calling upon his Lord to guide Professor Morrison's wisdom and reveal his special purpose for being there today. The reason I was there was because I emailed him and said, could I come along to one of these meetings? So it didn't have any, but it had a whole series of other mysterious purposes for them. And then I was asked to say something. I had no idea what to say, but I hoped I was guided by God in what I was going to say. But was the expression. And so when Jews are always cornered, they say, they quote the Psalms. They say how good it is for brothers to, you know, sit together. And it was the first thing that came to my mind. And a leading preacher said to me, oh, he said, that was so beautiful. He said, it's such a lovely language, your language. And I said, oh, thank you. And he said, carry on, speak to us in Maori. And I said, no, that wasn't Maori, that was Hebrew. And he said, Hebrew? Well, why did you speak to us in Hebrew? And he said, I thought you came from New Zealand. And I said, I do come from New Zealand. I spoke to you in Hebrew, but it's the language of the Old Testament. And he looked at me, he said, no. He said, the language of the Old Testament, the Old Testament was written in English. And he said, in 1854 it was translated in Samoan. And so the resonances, the histories are different. And we're not talking about we're all ignorant, but we're all ignorant within our specific histories. I mean, we don't get what's outside of them. And so the issues that we need to address are radically different. I've just come back from Samoa again, where we've been dealing with churches who are in tensions and conflicts with each other, and they're all Christian, except that some people don't see other people as Christian. And so Christians and Jews are categories. There are some Jews who don't see other Jews as Jews. There are some Christians who categorically, face-to-face, refuse to recognize each other as Christians. So these are complexifying issues. What I wanted to say was the issue is best practice. There are some wonderful suggestions in there, and there are excellent models. I went 1 year to Jonathan Magenay's Jewish Christian Bible Week in Bendorf in Germany. I don't know if anyone's ever been. It was absolutely wonderful. Wonderful to spend a week studying Scripture together. It's slow. It takes a week to do very much. But it's the first time I came to think. My view was a very simple one. If you can read, I can read Greek, I can read Latin, I can read the Bible, what's the problem? You know, I can see what these Christians are on. But in fact, being in the room with people, I mean, deliberating is the time you can ask the questions you can't ask. Why do you see that? And it's normally another verse, a piece of theology, something that's not discovered, something brought to the text that I can't access because of formation, because of background. And the same is true of Jewish texts. We don't read them just as they are. We read them through an implicit midrashic tradition. And we bring our tradition to our text. And the only way we can share that is painstakingly slow. We read, two books of the Bible in a week, and we picked the shortest ones to make it easy. And Jonah's not that interesting. What I'm trying to say is that there are models, but they're slow models, and we need to develop them. We need to read Scripture together. We need to read difficult texts. We need discussions about Israel, about politics, about theology, about supersessionism, about presuppositions. There's a harder call on the Jewish community. And my experience of teaching many of the young Jewish people in Wellington, who take my Judaism course, is that they are notoriously ignorant. Not only about Judaism, that goes without saying, but they're notoriously ignorant of Christianity. The times I spent in Israel needs this even more generally. The Israeli students I taught at the Hebrew University for a term know nothing about Islam except prejudicial things. They know even less about Christianity. But the awful thing is they have a confidence which suggests they know, a great deal about both of them. And the world we live in has changed. My bubby told me when I asked her when I was six, what's the difference between the two churches in the area where we live? One was Protestant, one was Catholic. I didn't know that at the time. But my grandmother did, who was from Europe, and she gave me a very long Yiddish explanation. And she explained to her, she said, well, they're not really the same. She said, in that one over there, she said, they worship a man on a cross. She said, in that one over there, they worship my mother and child. Now, it's deeply theological and almost correct, but the time when that was sufficient for Jews is over. I mean, we need to understand more than that. A well-publicized Mori survey in 2007 showed that 35% of people had no or almost no acquaintances of different faiths. That was done in England, made headlines. I suspect the figure is even higher in New Zealand. We don't know each other, and friendship, personal contact, and New Zealand has tremendous advantages on that front. We're small, we can go out of our way to make that difference. I suppose I've got lots of other things to say. I was scribbling when you were saying, but I ought to stop. I was worried about democracy and dialogue, religious dialogue, but let's go. What I want to say finally, is we're the good guys. We're here, we're good faith. It's the people who aren't here that we need to be addressing. It's the people who we don't meet who are doing Christian groups on campus that I go out of my way to annoy. It's people we know within our own communities. They may not go to our church or our shul, but we know who they are and we know where they are. And we have to take the risk of rebuttal. We have to take the risk of being offensive. We have to take the risk, of going out of our way to spread good news, which is good news, but isn't always there to be received. As we say in New Zealand, make a start, bite the bullet, that's what Americans say, and we say, it's time to suck the lemon. Thank you.
When I got over my shock, horror, and deep